The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition for this week. Have a little different format slash setup for you today. Jim's not joining us today on this EDU show. We're instead going to chat a little bit about the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, how some provisions might affect those of you out in retirement land or approaching retirement, since that's kind of what we talk about usually. And for that conversation, we've got Paul with us today, who's been on the show several times in the past. Paul's a CPA, he's part of our tax team. And Jake, who's been on the show a number of times recently, but the difference there is Jake's actually out here in Colorado with us. So Jake is in the penthouse. I'm not recording from home today. I'm at the office, and Jake is in the penthouse suite, which I'm sure he's heard a lot about, but probably never visited in person. But he's recording there today. And like I said, we're going to talk about not every provision. Not only is it one big, beautiful bill, it's one big, large, big bill. So there's a lot to go through, a lot of stuff in there, stuff that some people wished was in there isn't in there. And there's a whole bunch of stuff some people didn't expect to be in there. And a lot of things that have been talked about as this thing kind of made its way through Congress and ultimately signed by the president. So, thanks, Paul, for joining us here.
You're welcome. And actually, as we tape this, I am counting down the hours before I hop on a flight to Scotland to go play golf. I think I'm at 77 hours and counting.
Nice. So is the trip specifically to go to Scotland and golf, or are there other things going on in Scotland?
It is strictly to go play St. Andrews, Carnoustie, and I think three or four other courses. So I think hopefully I'll have fun.
I think it would be difficult not to enjoy that.
And it looks like right now, it looks like the weather forecast shows very little rain.
Interesting. But there'll be some breezes, though.
And we're counting on that.
And kind of hilly terrain. The bumps, right? The typical Scottish golf course.
So, the rub of the green.
Jake, you're not heading to Scotland. You came to the wonderful world of Colorado instead.
I did.
So how was your you obviously made it since you're here. Hopefully the travel was uneventful.
Yeah, we made it. A few delays, but it's great. Good to be here at the office with everybody today and recording from this beautiful penthouse that is even more luxurious than Jim has described it.
Yeah, he kind of downplays it, but it's actually quite nice. It's very private, has its own ensuite facilities.
Lovely ensuite bathroom with its own attendant, heated and cooled floors. It's quite swanky up here.
Yeah, so everybody who hears Jim complain about it all the time now. Now you know what the real scoop is. Exactly.
And a very nice antique table.
Oh, I love it. Very nice antique table. Something right out of Antique Roadshow, for those who are familiar. This thing would fetch some serious dollars at auction, I think.
I'm sure Jim will have something to say about that.
I'm sure.
anyway, so let's talk a little bit about this big, beautiful bill, and has quite a number of provisions that will affect all taxpayers, and some provisions that in particular will be of interest to those in our, I guess you call it our podcast target age group, which are those approaching retirement and in retirement. So we'll just kind of go through this. We're not going to be able to talk about the entire bill today. We don't have quite that long, but we'll touch on quite a number of these things. First, let's talk about kind of the most obvious extension, because a lot of, you know, this bill has a ton to do with tax rules, which, first let's talk about tax rates and the tax brackets, which of course, back in 2017, shifted temporarily at the time. It was always set under the Tax Cuts and Job Act back in when it went into effect in 2017. The personal brackets, the rates, and the brackets themselves were set to sunset, go back to their old inflation-adjusted versions here in 2026 coming up. And instead, they address those. So, Paul, kind of what's the rundown on those rates and brackets?
Yeah, so let's look at what the rates would have been if we didn't have this bill. They would have gone back. Now, the 10% would have stayed the same, but then we would have had a 15%, 25%, 28%, 33%, 35%, and then a top rate of 39.6%. Instead, we're going to keep the 10 and the 12%, then the 22%, 24%, 32%, 35%, and 37%. And those are made permanent. Of course, we know permanent means until Congress decides to make changes. Now, the one little quirk is that there's a special sort of inflation adjustment. We think it's on the 10 and the 12% bracket, and we think it applies starting next year, where we get an extra inflation adjustment. So let's say the inflation was originally 2%. We'll go back 1 year, and let's say the rate back, and I think it refers back to 2016, was, let's say, 1.8%. So for those brackets, they'll get like a 3.8% adjustment instead of a 2% adjustment. Again, I'm just using example percentages there. I think they had to do that in order to meet what was called the birdbath rules in the Senate. You can't make something permanent without making a change to it, so to speak, in order to get it through the Senate rules. So I think that's why they tweaked it a teeny weeny bit.
Yeah, because I had heard that as it was going through, there was like a one-time increase in the brackets themselves, which is advantageous because as they raise the brackets, as you're filling those brackets with income to be taxed upon, the higher the brackets are, the more is going to go in those lower brackets, the 10 bracket, the 12 bracket, et cetera. So it's in everyone's best interest for those brackets to be higher than lower. And
yes,
wasn't there a time where it was going to be a 5% increase one time in those brackets or something like that?
I don't remember a 5% increase. I think originally they might have been talking about an across the board increase for all of the brackets. I think that was in there. But like I say, I think what actually passed was for the 10 and 12% for individuals and then the 10% bracket for estates and trusts. So this is a small adjustment, a very small adjustment. And that might have been in order for them to sort of meet their, you know, deficit reduction goals, because if they adjusted all the brackets by that extra 1 or 2% for all the brackets, that would have cost more money than just doing it on the 10 and the 12.
Got it. Okay. But for the most part, then the brackets and the rates that we've been, you know, seeing over the past 8 years effectively are just extended indefinitely until there's a proactive change. There's no automatic sunset provision now.
Yep. Exactly.
Yeah.
This is permanent, whatever that might mean, but it is permanent.
Okay.
Permanent in pencil, as all things are.
Right. So kind of hand in hand with the brackets, the standard deduction, has that been changed?
Yes. So the original standard deduction for this year was going to be $15,000 for singles, $30,000 for married filing joint, and then about half that difference for the head of household. And what the BBB did was increase that by an extra $750 for singles. So it, instead of $15,000, you'll get $15,750. And then for married couples, you'll get $31,500. And then the head of household is, I don't have it in front of me, but it's, again, almost exactly half of the difference between $15,750 and $31,500.
That must have been where my brain went awry on the 5% increase instead of the brackets. It was actually the standard deductions that got that one-time 5% bump.
And that did happen.
Yeah.
So you're correct.
That
it
must
is,
be
it
my,
is on this day.
My bad yeah. memory. And since I heard them also working on the brackets, somehow I combined those two. I wonder anecdotally, and I mean, you, both of you, Jake and Paul, have your hands in the tax preparation we do for clients, and we don't do a huge number of tax returns, but do you have any sense for, you know, retirees of kind of our, you know, typical listener, typical clients that are, you know, upper middle class, I'd say, as a label, if you will, that how many use the standard deduction versus itemize? I know, you know, usually later in life, you run out of some of the typical things that you would list on your itemized deductions. So I think the number grows. That's the sense I get. But you guys are in a lot better position to know kind of how many itemize versus take the standard deduction, say in the, you know, 65-year-olds, you know, that have already retired. So no work related stuff. What do you think that is?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, Paul, I want to say maybe 10% itemize, at least of amongst our tax clients.
I would say that's pretty close.
Yeah.
Now, I think with the changes, when we talk about the state and local tax deduction, I think that number is going to increase beginning with the 25 returns.
Yeah, I agree.
But yeah, I think you're right. For those that have a house that's fully paid off, the state and local tax deduction was limited to $10,000 under the old rules. Very few of the clients actually itemize unless they decided to maybe pre-fund the donor advised fund and put $100,000 into it or something. But not very many did that.
Yeah, potentially if there were some larger medical expenses, you know, we may tip over into itemizing there. But again, those are not, you know, kind of a one-off type of year usually.
Mm-hmm. The reason I ask that is that, you know, this increase in the standard deduction, that's going to be impactful for, as you guys just mentioned, you know, 90% maybe, at least in our sample of folks that are retired. So that's increases there are something that would definitely help in that regard. And we may as well, since you kind of brought it up in your answer, the SALT, the state and local taxes that if you were itemizing, certainly those are the types of things you would include in your list of itemized deductions. But there were some, by what you know, most people, welcome changes to the SALT limits. Why don't you explain what happened there, Paul?
Yeah, so under the current rules before the bill passed, you were limited to a $10,000 maximum personal deduction. This increases that limit up to $40,000. So let's say under you're currently between your state income taxes and your real estate tax on your house, especially in higher tax states such as New York or New Jersey or California, if your total of those is about $45,000, $50,000, $60,000, under the old rules, you could only deduct $10,000 of that. The new rule says you can deduct up to $40,000 of it. However, as your income, and it doesn't matter if you're single or married, so there's still a little bit of a married penalty here.
Right.
You have the same deduction whether you're single or married. As your modified adjusted gross income, and for almost all of the people listening on this podcast, it's going to be your adjusted gross income because the additions are just for certain foreign source income type things. So for most people, it's going to be adjusted gross income. You're not going to add back like tax exempt interest or anything like that. So as your income goes from $500,000 up to $600,000, at the $600,000 level, you're going to be back to the $10,000 deduction or limit.
Yep.
And it's going to be phased out. So it's going to drop from 40,000 down to 10,000. So essentially a 30% reduction as you go from go through that $500,000 to $600,000 level. Now, for those people on the podcast that might be in that situation, your tax bracket could be as high as 45.5% because you might be in that bracket where 33 or 35% bracket, you have that extra 30% on top of it. So at the federal level, you could be at the 45.5% bracket. Plus, if you're like in California or other high tax states, you could approach easily approach for that $100,000 range. You could easily approach a 55% or higher tax bracket.
Effective rate
for that $100,000 phase out. So good news, unless you happen to be in that bracket. But even it's technically not worse than you were before.
Right.
You just would go back eventually to where you were before. Now, again, this is only for 25 through 2029. Through 2029. In 2030, unless they change it, but in 2030, it will revert back to the $10,000 hard cap.
Interesting.
So just give people a little historical perspective. We know it's do you have at your fingertips when the 10,000 limit went into effect? Was that part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act?
Yes.
Yeah, it was 2017.
Yeah, it went into effect in 2018.
So 2017. And was there a SALT limit prior to that, or was it unlimited?
It was unlimited, but indirectly, in a way, there was a SALT limit in the fact that for alternative minimum tax purposes, which we really don't want to talk about too much, but under AMT, the state and local tax deduction was non-deductible. So effectively, at some point, if you're a high enough income taxpayer and you had a large amount of SALT deduction, at some point you would hit a cap, but it was not a specific number. It would just depend on the situation. So before that, it was an unlimited deduction for regular tax purposes.
So that 10 grand was a, you know, pretty big change for a lot of high income folks that would also obviously have high state and local taxes for a variety of reasons, right? They kind of go hand in hand. If you make a lot of money, you probably have a more valuable house, which leads to higher property taxes. You're also paying higher income taxes in your state. So, higher income individuals really felt it with that $10,000 SALT limit. So at least now it's bounced back up to a larger limit of 40,000. But again, if you're a high income earner at $500,000 or more, then that's going to be whittled away. Plus, this is at least right now, temporary relief,
right,
since it goes away in 2030 without congressional action. I always find this. Go ahead.
I was going to say some listeners might have a business where they're part of what's called a flow-through entity, an LLC or an S corporation. They're able to deduct that state income tax in full. There was a lot of discussion in both the House and the Senate bill that they were going to reduce the value of that deduction. And neither of those provisions made it into the final bill. The only provision that got in there was the $40,000 cap. So that's good news for those that are in those type of professions.
Yeah, and I think from a planning opportunity, I know this doesn't apply to everyone, but if you do, or you're kind of projecting your income to fall within that close to 500 or between 500 and 600, a really important planning opportunity, you know, before the end of this tax year, to really get a handle on how to take advantage of that maximum, if there is a way, by reducing your adjusted gross income, could have a pretty significant impact for folks in that range.
And this is a case, Chris and Jake, where you may want to bunch some Roth conversions. You know, you might do a Roth conversion in 1 year because you know you're going to be under there, or maybe you're going to be fully over it, or you're going to be through there. And then the next year you're going to be under it, so you can stay in that lower tax bracket. Of course, for most of our listeners, I think we're doing a Roth conversion typically in that 22 to 24% bracket. And, you know, the $500,000 level is higher than that. So we still might be okay.
Yeah. And I was thinking maybe there's for people that have that kind of level of income, because that's pretty, that phase out is pretty darn aggressive. Yes. Over that $100,000, essentially wiping away $30,000 of deductions over that $100,000, 500 to 600 phase out. What are some things that, if someone were trying to manipulate, sounds like, you know, such a bad word, but manipulate's the right answer, the right description, manipulate your AGI in order to maybe reduce it to, you know, not face the consequences of that phase out on the SALT. What are some typical people doing in that kind of income range that might, you know, might help with that?
Well, certainly, I think if you're an employee, if you haven't maximized your your 401k and so on, that would be helpful. Now, that may not be enough, but if you're a business owner and you don't have you're a sole proprietor business owner and you don't have any type of pension plan or profit sharing plan set up, you know, taking advantage of that, you could certainly possibly put in and deduct $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 in 1 year. So that could get you under that. That's typically, you know, fully funding your HSA. Right. If you have an HSA, you know, if you don't have, if you're not participating in a pension plan, you know, fully funding your IRAs, because at that point they would still be deductible, assuming you have earned income. Jake, what are some of the other ones you can think of? Maybe I jump to the top of some of the easier ones.
Yeah, I'd say then, I mean, you increase your deductions through, if you're charitably inclined, you know, maybe looking at.
Well, the problem with that, Jake, is remember this phase out is based on AGI. So,
true.
You know, doing any type of charitable contribution, yes, you'll get the value of that, but you're still quoting that 45% plus or minus bracket as you go from, you know, adjusted gross income of 500 to 600,000. So, you know, typically for, you know, business owners, then they might make certain business investments, you know, they might buy new equipment and so on to keep them under that number. So, but for the typical rank and file, you know, really probably the best one is the ones that we mentioned, you know, retirement plans, IRAs or HSAs.
Yeah, that's the obvious one I was thinking of too, is that just, you know, shove money in to defer income through traditional pre-tax
and some
contributions.
And probably many of our listeners maybe are employed at a company that allows them to defer. You know, they have a qualified deferred compensation type plan at work. So maybe they'll defer an extra $50,000 or $100,000 into that plan and know that when it comes out, they'll be below that $500,000 level. So certainly for those that have that option, that's a great tool. Take advantage of that.
True.
Okay. I guess the only other thing would be looking at the taxation of any investment income, I guess, could potentially, you know, I mean, you're not going to move the needle a whole lot, but, you know, since the tax exempt interest isn't being added back for this look at modified adjusted gross income, that could be an opportunity to look
at.
Or
if you had some type of large capital gain that happened during the year, maybe tax loss harvesting, you know, that certainly could help reduce that gain.
Or spreading it out, like you mentioned earlier. I think those are all things. But I mean, if you're two salaried employees, you know, making $350,000 each. I mean, yeah, you're probably not going to get it below $500,000. Yeah. So that's a good problem to have.
Sure. So targeted, you know, kind of at our retiree age group. So let's talk about the personal exemption, this new personal exemption for 65 and over that, again, is for a short period of time, right? Kind of like that SALT increase was only for a few years before it sunsets. This personal exemption, let's explain, you know, what that is and how it affects people that happen to be in the age group that where it works here.
Yeah. So essentially before TCJA, before the Trump tax cuts back in 17, everybody had a personal exemption and TCJA basically kept the personal exemption, but they put a value of zero on it. So everybody got zero. Well, they've permanently eliminated the regular personal exemptions, but for those seniors that are age 65 or older, you are allowed to, and this is for a four-year period, so for 25, 26, 27, and 28. So for those 4 years, each of you will get an extra $6,000 personal exemption. However, it will then start to phase out as your adjusted gross income exceeds $75,000 if you're single, or $150,000 if you're a joint filer. So if you're under that level, you get an extra personal exemption of $6,000 for one or two if you're both, if you're married and you're both over that age. But as your income goes over those levels, there'll be a permanent, there'll be a phase out, and that's at the 6% level. So you have a $100,000 phase out range for that $6,000 deduction to be eliminated.
Right. So the phase out just starts at the 75 and 150 that you mentioned. Correct. It's not complete at that time.
Right. It's not a cliff. It's just a phase out over the next $100,000 of adjusted gross income.
Right. So you'd be phased out as a single filer over 175, 175,000 and married filing jointly now, fully phased out at 250.
You know, remember that President Trump had, as part of his campaign, said we're going to have no tax on Social Security. Chris, I've even heard that on the Social Security website, I haven't looked at it, but I've heard on the Social Security website, like on July 4th or July 5th, they even put something on there that almost made it sound like they'd eliminated taxes on Social Security. This did not eliminate taxes on Social Security. This is just an extra deduction for those age 65 and older. Because remember, if you're 62, 63, and 64, and you're on Social Security, you get no extra exemption. Mm-hmm. This is only if you're 65 or older. And so there, and remember the reason for that, again, we go back to the budget reconciliation process. One of those rules is that you can't affect the Social Security Trust Fund, essentially, and the taxes on Social Security income is going into that Social Security Trust Fund. Right. So that's why we could not eliminate taxes on Social Security directly.
Yeah, there was, I'm sure they also posted it on the website. I received one of the emails that many, many of you out there received where initially right after the signing of this bill, there was an email that at least implied, if not overtly stated, depending on your interpretation of the wording, that 90% of people that collect Social Security would not pay income tax on their Social Security. That was a, I would call that at least an exaggeration of how this works. It was not technically correct how it works. Again, like Paul said, there's been no changes as to the taxability of Social Security. The Social Security income is still brought into your taxable income under the same formula that it was previously used. Right. There's, depending on your level of provisional income, they call it, a certain percentage, up to 85% of your Social Security gets scraped over into the taxable income on your tax return. That all is true. What you now have, though, if you're 65 or older for a brief time from 25 through 28, is this extra $6,000 personal exemption is how it's labeled, which reduces, you know, what income is affected by taxes. And I think that was their attempt at trying to help people that are of Social Security age, right? Even though they couldn't ultimately, and they really can't because of what Paul's mentioned, and I'll state it here, just, you know, I guess emphasize it because Paul did mention it, that the income taxes collected on your Social Security benefits, if your Social Security benefits fall into that taxable category, actually go into the Social Security Trust Fund to help fund Social Security benefits. It's a carve off. It actually diverts over. It doesn't just go into the regular budget process. It gets separated. So it's part of the changes back when taxability of Social Security was instituted. It was instituted in order to shore up the system that had a inflow outflow problem that still exists to this day, to delay the time when there wouldn't be enough money there to pay out promised benefits. And one way to do that was to tax it and take those taxes and divert it into the Social Security system itself. So if they were to just wave a magic wand and remove the taxes on Social Security benefits, they would be reducing the inflows into the system. And I already mentioned, as we all should be aware of, that Social Security suffers to this day from a cash outflow, cash inflow problem. It's a simple math problem. Mm-hmm. More money flows out than flows in. The only reason that is sustainable at this point is that for a while, more money flowed in than flowed out, allowing them to build up a cushion in the trust fund. We are now eating through that cushion, and it's that cushion that is supposed to be exhausted in the early 2030s. So we're getting really close here, right? It's 2025 mm-hmm. as we record this. And for them to, you know, change the inflow outflow math and have the system not become worse than it is now, they'd have to address a lot of things, and they didn't. You know, that's the Social Security, you know, revisions, restructuring, alterations, whatever you want to call it, weren't attacked in this bill. As big as this bill is, it didn't touch any of the basics, problems of Social Security. So this was, I think, you know, and because a lot of people are claiming that this gives you benefits, you know, allows you to not pay taxes on your Social Security, which is an exaggeration of how it really works. This was a way for them to include something that felt a little bit like benefits, you know, a tax benefit for people who are collecting Social Security.
But it's not addressing the root issue.
Yeah, it doesn't address the root issue and also doesn't change the basic taxability. It's just a carve out for people 65 and older for a 4-year period. You know, you get this extra exemption, which is beneficial.
Sure.
Right? It's beneficial, but it's not technically tied to Social Security at all. It's a completely separate thing. You'll get this benefit even if you don't collect Social Security.
So right. Another thing to factor in during your tax planning, you know, especially if you're looking at Roth conversions and various things, is looking at, all right, if this is going to push us out of this exemption, you know, is it worth it based on the totality of your retirement plan? You know, those are questions you want to kind of consider now.
Right.
And that means your marginal tax bracket, if you're single, will go up by an extra about 1.5% if you're in that phase out range. And if you're a married couple and you're both receiving the deduction, you know, your marginal tax bracket, instead of being 22%, will be closer to 25% during that phase out range. And indirectly, many people are better off under this than if they eliminate the taxation on Social Security. Because let's say your taxation or your amount of Social Security that was going to be taxed was $4,000. Well, if they eliminated the taxation on Social Security, you would have seen your income go down by $4,000. Here, your income goes down by $6,000.
Right.
So as long as your taxable Social Security is less than the $6,000 or the $12,000 for a married couple, net, you're actually getting an extra benefit.
Yeah, totally. And if you're getting, say you have a non-covered pension, where you don't even have Social Security, them changing the taxability of Social Security wouldn't have helped you at all. And this does.
Yeah.
Right? This would help you. So,
Again, the people that are being penalized on Social Security is if they're age 62, 63, and 64.
True.
Because they still are taxable on Social Security and get no extra exemption.
Or people who are on Social Security disability also don't get any benefit of this, because unless they're 65.
Right.
Right. So there's another group of people that kind of missed out on this benefit that are collecting Social Security benefits.
Well, and remind me, Chris, at 65, do they switch over to regular SSI at that point, or are they still on
SSI? They switch over to their retirement benefit at full retirement age.
Oh, so 67 which now would be 67. Right. So, okay.
Right. Yeah. Other big change, we talked about tax rates and brackets, but there's another tax that not too many people were affected by, but it was due to sunset, and that was the lifetime estate tax exemption. So that amount that if you pass away, and it's a combined limit that includes all of your lifetime giving, gifting above the annual exemption amount. And there was, you know, threats that could be greatly reduced, causing people that for quite some time were not really having to worry about estate taxes at their passing. If the estate tax limits dropped, you know, substantially, they might be captured by those estate taxes, not them, but their estate, because they'll be gone. But they made some changes there too. So let's talk about how the lifetime estate gift exemption has been altered.
Yeah. And I think the estate planning attorneys that might be listening to this are actually fairly confident that they might be able to celebrate Christmas this year, because without this change, they'd be working about 120 hours a week doing a lot of gifting for their clients. Yeah. So as Chris had mentioned, the old exemption for 2024 or 25 was $13,990,000. Let's round it to 14 million. Mm-hmm. Starting next year, as of January 1st, if you happen to pass away after December 31 of this year, the exemption was scheduled to drop to approximately 7.2, 7.3 million, somewhere in that range. Mm-hmm. And what the bill did is they said, and they could have maybe just made it permanent at the higher level, because next year it would have been about 14.2, 14.3, somewhere in that range. But instead, they increased it up to 15 million, make it permanent, and then index it to inflation starting in 2027. So for next year, married couple could be worth 30 million, especially with portability, can be worth $30 million and not owe any federal estate tax. Now, if you're in states such as Washington, which now has a maximum tax rate, estate tax rate, of 35% once your estate goes over $9 million. If you live in Washington state, you're subject to a 35% top tax rate, which means you're about 61% combined federal and estate. But at least at the federal level, married couples can be worth $30 million starting next year and not owe any estate taxes at all.
Interesting. So that's welcome relief for those who, you know, might have been in that 8-9 million potentially level that, if it dropped to where it was scheduled to drop to, would then have to change their plans or, you know, be subjected to it. There are, you know, a lot of estate planning techniques that were in existence to, kind of navigate the waters of an environment with much, much lower estate tax limits. But this now, at least, you know, as far as permanent goes, permanent till Congress changes it, of course, makes things simple for a vast majority of people, because there's a very small percentage of folks in the United States that end up having an estate for as a married couple over $30 million. Right. It's still a small group. So that group has a good problem to have, and we'll be doing some more creative estate planning.
So. Exactly. My two favorite estate planning techniques, you know, for those folks are to spend it or give some more away. I think those are great ways to reduce your estate.
That's a good strategy, right? Instead of leaving it all behind.
Don't need an attorney.
True. Okay.
Or fully fund some 529s for your grandkids. Yeah. You know, that's what's definitely what my wife and I are starting to do.
I'm glad you brought that up. Let's dispel a myth about 529s. I know there's a little segue from this, but there's a common misconception that there is a relatively low limit for how much you can contribute to a 529 for, you know, whatever beneficiary that you're trying to do that for, usually a child or a grandchild, but could be anybody. When in fact, it's more, there's a limit on how much – no, let me take it back. There is a certain dollar amount that once your 529 has reached that limit for a particular dependent or beneficiary, that at that point you can contribute no more. So it kind of creates this arbitrary overall limit to how big a 529 can get from contributions, but then it can actually grow beyond that with return, you know, interest, whatever, however it's invested. It's that limit that exists. You really in now there's some state level variations here that if you might lose state deductibility of the contribution over certain annual limits, but at the 529, you know, federal level for gifting, there's no limit, not like on your IRA, where, you know, you can only put in $8,000 that you qualify for. you could literally put hundreds of thousands of dollars into a 529 all at once for your grandchild. There is no limit. It gets recognized as a gift of that amount to that beneficiary. And as long as you don't butt up against your state defined overall limit on to the balance of that account, you can contribute that all in 1 year if you want to. There is no, you don't have to dribble it in $5,000 a year or something like that. If you want to offload, and this could be a great estate planning opportunity, if you've got the money, why not just move, shift it over as a large amount to each one of your grandchild's 529 plans? And now, of course, that's going to start going against your lifetime estate slash gift exemption. That $15 million we mentioned is combined for the two of those things. But since you brought up 529s, I just wanted to kind of dispel that myth that you've got to stay within, say, the annual $19,000 annual gift limits or something like that. You don't have to do that. You might end up having to file a gift tax return, but you're allowed to contribute massive amounts actually into a 529 all at once if you so choose.
Yeah. And one additional thing on that, Chris, is you have a special 5-year sort of get out of jail free card.
Right.
You're correct. If you give more than $19,000 of cash or other assets to your child or your grandchild, you have to file a gift tax return. It's the excess above $19,000 is going to eat into your lifetime exemption, but you're not going to owe any gift tax. However, there's a special carve out for Section 529 plans that allow you to fund up to 5 years worth of contributions under that $19,000. So five times $19,000 is $95,000.
Right.
So you can fully fund $95,000 in the first year, so to speak, and not have that reduce your lifetime exemption.
Right.
It'll so just that, be, that is a special.
Yeah, it'll just be kind of clawing forward or accelerating the use of those annual. Now, what you've done there, so everybody knows, you've utilized your annual gift exclusion to that person for the next 5 years. You've claimed it.
Correct.
So any additional gifts above that would have to be a gift tax return. The other thing to remember too is in year six, you get another 5-year opportunity. So you could do 5 years worth, and then 6 years later, you can do another 5 years worth all at once. And then you know, every 6 years, technically, you could do that. So it kind of restarts again after that 5-year period is over, which is also another interesting opportunity.
But remember, if the beneficiary has some excess funds when they get done with their higher, secondary college, whatever it might be, they can roll over up to $35,000. Mm-hmm. I think if my memory's right, $35,000 into a Roth.
Yep. Or correct. You can change the beneficiary to someone else in the family who could use it.
Exactly.
So all kinds
including
of,
yourself.
And don't be scared of gift tax returns, people. If you want to give, go ahead and give. They're not overly complex.
I'm glad you brought that up too. That's a good another segue. Some people are scared to death of the idea of filing a gift tax return. Like suddenly they're going to be thrust into purgatory and I'll be inundated with hundreds of papers of extra and thousands of dollars of consultation costs with attorneys. And there's just this fear that, well, no, I can't give more than $19,000 to this person because then I'd have to file a gift tax return. Why don't you, one of you, describe what that experience is actually like?
Yeah, it's really quite straightforward. If you're interested, look up form 709. That's your U.S. gift tax return. It's very, very simple. You're just, filling out how much that you had donated, who's the recipient. And really, that's about it. There's some other line items there, but it's a very straightforward form. And then that just, lets the IRS know that, hey, I gave in excess to my annual exclusion amount this year. It'll be applied towards that, $15 million or whatever it is at the time, lifetime gift exemption, and you move on with your life. You don't pay tax on it. It's done.
And I think some of the other misconceptions, I hear this fairly often, my kids are going to have to pay tax on this. They've gotten this $19,000. No, this is tax-free to the child, but conversely, you don't get a deduction. So it's a non-event. So now there's certain times when you can have some income realizations, but that's more complicated than this show.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. Next thing, there's been, for those of people who do itemize, we talked about itemizing deductions versus taking the standard deduction, but for those who do itemize, there's a change in the rules for those in higher brackets. What's going on there? Because it is some of those people in, you know, higher income folks, particularly pre-retirees, might still have a big mortgage and things like that are itemizing. But what's the change there?
Yes. Yeah, so under the rules before TCJA, so back in 17 and before, there was a limit for higher income taxpayers on how much of the deductions, itemized deductions, they could deduct. Well, that's was or temporarily suspended through 2025. Now it's been eliminated, but they've replaced it. And what it says is for the, let's say that your itemized deductions are $100,000 and you're $45,000 over the 37% bracket. What it's saying is once you go over the 37% bracket or into that 37% bracket, we're going to reduce your itemized deductions by 237. So essentially they're going to say, we're going to give you the value at the 35% level, not at the 37% level, but it's on the lesser of your itemized deductions or how much income you've gone into that 37% bracket. So my quick little example, 100,000, you're not going to lose 237ths of 100,000. You're just going to lose 237ths of 45,000, the amount of income that's over that, over the 37% bracket. And there's another quirk on this, the Section 199 Cap A deduction, that extra little 20% deduction for business owners and so on, that's sort of excluded in this calculation. So, but just realize that if you're going to be in the 37% tax bracket, you're going to lose about 5% worth of your not quite about 5%. Yeah, about 5% value of your itemized deductions.
Okay. Another hot topic for a lot of retirees are ACA premium tax credits. So ACA, the Affordable Care Act, as part of that, which, wow, does that go back to 2020? Was the original ACA?
No, it was
2012.
2012. Oh my gosh, I feel old now. So the original ACA, as part of that, to make premiums more affordable for low-income folks, there were credits that were built into the system to help you pay for premiums at certain income levels. And then it was the ACA credits were revised over time. But again, due to sunset, I don't think they were ever made permanent. But why it plays a role for retirees is a lot of times, first of all, as a young person, a lot of people use ACA credits when they're in their 20s because they have maybe an entry-level job, don't make a lot of money. But they have the benefit at least of being young and having access to medical insurance that is a – they may not think so. I'll tell you, my kids don't think health insurance is cheap. But I always try to point out to them how much a 60-year-old would have to pay. Right. So there's that group. But where ACA comes back is for people who retire. They were part of an employer plan that had health insurance at work at – likely a subsidized by their employer reasonable premium, even though it was substantial, it was probably quite reasonable compared to market rates. And then they find themselves maybe as a 60-year-old, too young to file or to enter Medicare, which happens at 65, but no longer having access to their employer plan. So they're out in the open marketplace. And in most states, a decent medical plan for a 60-year-old is going to run you north of $1,000 a month per person. That's not for a couple. Now there's variations, right? There's bronze plans, silver plans, gold plans, and you know there's some things in there. But from what I'm from what I'm seeing, a decent plan, which I consider a silver plan decent, $1,100, $1,150, $1,200 is oftentimes the cost, which is really expensive when they were maybe used to paying a couple hundred dollars a month at their employer. Now their employer was paying a whole bunch to subsidize that, but still they were used to 200. Now it's 1200. That's shocking. So a lot of folks in that category actually have fairly low income levels. Doesn't necessarily mean they have low amount of assets, but they can actually have low income levels. They haven't reached RMD age yet. They haven't filed for Social Security yet. They don't have a pension maybe. They just don't have a lot of taxable income, AGI specifically, adjusted gross income, and they qualify for credits. And so when they expanded those credits, it allowed a lot of folks with reasonable wealth to actually qualify for credits. I wanted to give that whole preamble, I know it's kind of long, to set the stage for what has changed now with those ACA premium tax credits that helped people offset premiums that, again, in their 60s can be very, very high till they get on Medicare, which the reason why those premiums are less expensive is they're subsidized once again. The Medicare taxes that are paid into the system, I always think of it as I'm paying Medicare taxes my whole life, kind of prepaying part of the premiums that I'm going to be charged for health insurance once I'm 65. It's not technically what's going on, but that's kind of the way I feel about it. And but until I hit Medicare age, wow, I could be in this really expensive tier simply due to age on this, and ACA credits would be really handy. So what's the rundown on the changes to the ACA premium tax credits that so many people have been either receiving or hoping to receive?
Well, I think the key, Chris, is there is no changes. And so what do we mean by that? Under the CARES Act, and then it was extended by one other act during COVID period, there's been a special enhancement through the end of 2025 on the ACA premium credits as far as the amount of credit that you get based on your income and then how much you have to pay back. Because under the original rules, once you went over what was called 400% of the federal poverty level, then you had to pay back 100% of the premium tax credit that you received, which for some people is $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $25,000. I've seen at least $20,000 multiple times. They would have to pay back 100% of that credit, even though they went $1 over that threshold. So it's a cliff, not a phase out. So what the BBB did is absolutely nothing. So that means starting next year, we're back to, you're going to get less premium tax credit. You're going to qualify for much less, not much less, depending on the income level, but some cases much less premium tax credit. And the amount that you have to pay back is going to go up. And if you go over that 400% of the federal poverty level, then at that point, you have to pay back 100% of your premium tax credit that you received when you signed up for the health insurance. So this is something for a lot of the listeners here during that transition area, you know, where you've retired from work, but you're not Medicare age yet. You're on the exchange. You want to be very careful to make sure you stay under those levels next year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this will be a big one for quite a number of people. There was a lot of people, like I said, with fairly healthy income and good level of assets that qualified for some decent ACA credits because of the CARES Act and the subsequent enhancements that happened there that removed kind of that cliff effect, made it more of a glide, you know, a transition for quite some time. And you could have a fair amount of income recognition in a year and still get some ACA credits. And that's going to go back kind of to the original version. So you're right that there's no change in here, which they're allowing then the changes that were temporarily implemented to expire, which is going to bring back the old version, right? The old version of those premium tax credits. So just a heads up on that, if you've been enjoying them, if you last couple years you retired a little bit early, this is one of the reasons. I mean, I was always happy those premium tax credit came in. I personally wish they would lower the age of eligibility for Medicare at least to the age where you could claim Social Security. It just seems natural that those two things would happen simultaneously to me, to have Medicare available at 62.
But at that point, they would probably have to increase the tax rate for Medicare to pay for those extra 3 years of people being on the system.
Right, right. So it is a bummer because it is a pretty healthy chunk of money for those who have to just pay open market rates for medical insurance. And they just happen to be older, right? They're 60 instead of 25. 25, insurance pretty cheap. Those people don't go to the doctor a whole lot, and they're usually generally fairly healthy. But 60-year-olds, they pay the premiums that an older, more likely to have medical issues person would pay. It's just the way it is.
And remember, the House bill had proposed, I don't think it was in the Senate, but it was certainly in the House bill, had proposed that for those that, you know, they aren't really on Medicare, but they're automatically on Medicare, and they can't participate in a 529 plan. HSA plan. They were going to allow them to participate in the SA plan until they really went on full Medicare. I'm going to say, well, that didn't make it to the final bill. So you're still under the current rules or the old rules.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought, that's another one that people are confused by and a lot of times surprised by. So I think it's worthy of some conversation here. First of all, just know that as part of law, this isn't a judgment. The law is written that if you are of Medicare age, 65 or older, and you are a Social Security benefit recipient, you are automatically enrolled in Medicare Part A. Now, we never talk about Part A because it kind of flies under the radar, because for people who are what are called fully insured, which is a definition a category you meet after you've participated long enough in the Social Security / Medicare system through your payroll taxes, if you're fully insured, Medicare Part A is a free premium when you're receiving it. Now, for people who didn't participate, who aren't fully insured, you can still buy Medicare Part A. There is a premium attached to it. So for a very small number of people out there who want to have Medicare, who aren't fully insured, they can acquire Part A and Part B, which also has a premium, as we all know. But Part A is a premium, and it's typically called hospital insurance. So it's more covers things in the hospital. I think it covers dialysis and some blood transfer. There's a list of things that it covers, but mostly hospital stay is actually covered under Part A of Medicare. And I honestly am not sure of the reasoning behind this rule, other than if someone's fully insured, thus they would receive a Social Security retirement benefit, Medicare Part A is free. And I guess Congress thought, why would anyone not want it? Why would anyone not be on here? We may as well, so that they automatically get it, let's just set it up in the system that it's mandatory that Part A starts when they start claiming a Social Security benefit. So that's the fun fact first. That's the first fun fact, that when you're claiming Social Security and over 65, you are enrolled in Medicare whether you think you are or not. You're enrolled in Part A at least. What you don't have to enroll in, for a variety of reasons, is Part B and other parts of Medicare. But Part A, you get. It's forced upon you, and you can't opt out of it. There is no turning that off. Where that ties into HSAs is there's another rule that states if you are enrolled in Medicare, you are not eligible to make a contribution to an HSA, even though you might be enrolled in what would otherwise be an HSA-qualified high-deductible health plan. You might have one maybe at work or at, you know, you're in the ACA. There's states with ACA choices, policies that meet the high-deductible classification where you can still qualify to contribute to an HSA. But if you've turned on your Social Security benefit at 65 or over, or maybe you're already collecting when you hit 65, you must at that time stop contributing to an HSA. You will lose that ability because of this mandatory enrollment in Part A. And that's what Paul mentioned, the House version of the bill. They were bantering about maybe changing that because this burns a few people. Some people don't realize it. And then they've made an excess contribution into the HSA, and then it gets really messy and that sort of thing. So there was some talk about not, you know, about changing the rule where it doesn't mandatorily force you into Medicare Part A when you file for Social Security benefits. But it didn't make it. So that still is the rule. So be aware of that. Also be aware that if you sign up for Social Security after you turn 65, they're going to backdate your enrollment to Medicare back to 65 or 6 months, whichever is less. And there's also no way to undo that either. Yeah. So it people have been kind of burned in the transition where they maybe have been contributing to an HSA plan for a while, continue to do so, and they're doing it right up to the point where they enroll in Medicare, which if you do it right at 65, it can be pretty clean. But if you make that transition after 65, you might get some conflicts there in your HSA contribution eligibility and when you're actually enrolling in Medicare because of the backdating, the retroactive application of the Medicare. So kind of just things to be aware of and watch through there. I usually tell people, shut those HSA contributions off in plenty of time so you don't have to worry about fixing an excess contribution or something like that. Because the last couple $1,000s you might put into your HSA isn't worth the headache of trying to fix it if you put money in and you weren't supposed to. So just know that that's in there. Now there's HSA, since you brought it up, aren't there some other changes, Paul, to HSA participation?
Yeah, so essentially under the current rules or the old rules, I guess, essentially I think had to be at a silver plan in order to contribute to an HSA. Well, they've now dropped that down to a bronze plan and even a catastrophic plan. So as long as you meet the definitions of it being a high deductible plan, et cetera, HSA compliant plan, it can be a bronze or a catastrophic plan and still allow you to contribute to the HSA. So that's helpful if you feel like you're fairly healthy or you don't want to pay the higher premiums, but you want to put more money in to an HSA plan to help you fund your medical expenses during your retirement years. That's definitely going to be very helpful.
And that, as well as the kind of reverting of the premium tax credits, all start next year, so 2026.
Yes.
That's kind of a nice to have, but I'll say that I'm not super impressed by that for the following reason. Where HSAs really shine, I think, is when you're making HSA contributions while you're working, since those contributions to the HSA also avoid the Social Security and Medicare taxes. Not only are they income tax free, you avoid the payroll taxes on it. So it's a, you know, better than just avoiding income taxes. Once you've stopped working and you're on the marketplace, which is what Paul was talking about with the expansion of which ACA plans would qualify still for HSA contribution, you're not doing it through payroll reduction anymore. So you miss out on the avoiding payroll taxes. You do get the tax income tax-free benefits of the HSA. So I'm not saying it's nothing, but it's not as glorious as the tax trifecta, I guess, of the doing it through employer payroll deductions to make those HSA contributions. It's exceptionally glorious for those of you building an HSA balance, doing it via that method rather than just out of your own pocket, just to be, you know, just to emphasize.
But I would say, Chris, there's probably a lot of listeners on here that are in their working years, but they're self-employed and they don't get that extra benefit that people that are, you know, collecting a wage or being paid a salary are able to get that benefit. They're still going to be subject to self-employment tax on their earnings, and they don't get that reduction in the payroll taxes as far as contributing to an HSA. So there's still, you know, there's a several million, probably 50 million or more taxpayers out there that are self-employed.
Good point. Good point. It's too bad that they don't get the benefit of those, of avoiding self-employment taxes on their HSA contributions. That'd be a nice benefit.
It would be.
Couple other smaller, let's talk about maybe changes to charitable deductions. Aren't there some changes there that would affect a lot of people that are retired that end up having, you know, enough money to do what they want to do? They start giving away more maybe in retirement than they ever did while they were working. So charitable deductions are a topic for retirees. What changes can you mention there?
Well, since I've been dominating the conversation, I'm going to let Jake fill us in on that one.
Sure. Yeah, let me just pull up my notes here. Yeah, so an AGI-based kind of minimum level of charitable donations is going to be required in order to be deductible, and this starts next year with, you know, no sunset or end date. It essentially adds a kind of a wrinkle on how much of your charitable donations you can itemize if you're itemizing deductions. So starting in 2026, you're going to be able to itemize donations to the extent of all of your qualified donations exceed 0.5% of your adjusted gross income. So 0.5. So kind of a good analogy to this is if you think of, you know, those of you who maybe have itemized or tried to itemize medical expenses in the past, there was a 7.5% of AGI minimum in order to deduct those medical expenses. So for easy math, let's say your AGI was $100,000. Well, you would only be able to itemize those medical expenses above and beyond $7,500. Of medical expenses occurred in that year, or 7.5% of the AGI. So under this, you know, kind of wrinkle here would be, you know, using that same example of $100,000 AGI, you would need to have, you know, charitable donations above and beyond 500 in order to be able to itemize those deductions on your tax return.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting wrinkle.
Was my math right there?
Yeah. One additional benefit is that, right now your limit on cash donations, I'm going to call it cash donations, is 60% of your gross income. That was scheduled to revert back to 50% next year. And this bill makes that 60% level permanent. So that does help, you know, those taxpayers that want to give a little bit extra, you know, they have a large gift, maybe a donor advised fund. They're going to have an extra 10% of their gross income that they can deduct for the current year, but the penalty would be is that 0.5% is going to be non-deductible.
So that's really the wrinkle. So just throw another example. If someone had $200,000 of AGI and they donated 20,000, say, you know, 10% of that 20,000, the first 1,000 or 0.5% of the 200,000 of AGI, the first 1,000 of that 20 they gifted would not be deductible. They would just deduct the other 19,000.
That's correct.
Correct.
That's how it works.
But wasn't there also, Paul, I don't have this in front of me, but kind of similar to what was done in like 2020 and 21, where you can, without itemizing, you can still get like a $1,000 deduction if you donate to charity for a single, $2,000 for married filing jointly, didn't
they? So, yes, you're going to get an extra $1,000. So if you don't itemize, your standard deduction, essentially your standard deduction increases by $1,000 as long as you give at least $1,000 to charity. And then if you're a married couple, as long as you give at least $2,000 to charity, you're going to get a $33,500 deduction, standard deduction, essentially, instead of the old 30,000. So that's beneficial for those that want to give to charity, but don't have enough other itemized deductions to get them above the standard deduction.
Okay. Agreed. And I've got one more, since we've got a little time, but then we'll wrap up. So one more, car loan interest tax deduction I've got written down is not necessarily probably super interesting to retirees. But some people have car loans in retirement. So what's up with that? Because, you know, typically we haven't seen least in modern history, interest on car loans or vehicle loans being tax deductible. How is that a thing now?
So again, that was something that President Trump had promised during the campaign. So for new purchases of and it isn't just automobiles, it's basically anything that's got a motor where the final assembly is in the United States and the gross vehicle weight is less than 14,000 pounds. So that would be motorcycles, motorized tricycles, cars, pickups, SUVs, and so on. So for personal, this is personal interest, not in a business, that's still deductible. But for you buying a personal vehicle, up to $10,000 of that is allowed. Now, Jake and I were talking about this a little bit before the call. We don't know if this is part of AGI or if it's after AGI and before itemized deductions. There's a little bit of confusion exactly where this is going to go on the tax form, but it is a, we know it's not part of itemized deductions. We know that, but you can deduct up to $10,000. Now, there is a phase out once your income, and I'm trying to find my phase out. Do you have that for me, Jake?
Yeah, it starts at $100,000 of MAGI for single, $200,000 for filing jointly. And then the reduction is 20% of the amount of the AGI that's in excess of that phase out level income. So
yeah,
I guess that would be essentially married filing jointly would lose all deductibility if your MAGI is over $250,000.
Yeah. Yeah. $50,000 fully phased out. I guess there's an incentive possibly to buy, again, vehicles where the final assembly is in the United States. So if final assembly is in Canada or Mexico, you will not qualify for this deduction or potential deduction.
Yeah, my kind of head-scratching moment in this is I don't know that we want to encourage people to take on $10,000 of
car loan interest
when their income is less than $150,000. It just doesn't seem like a great plan. But that's just Jake's musings.
Yeah. Okay. Well, little disclaimer, I guess. There's some elements of this that are kind of up for interpretation. So there will be final interpretation given by the IRS over time as this goes by. As is typical in a bill like this, Congress puts forth their thoughts and intentions, and then sometimes there's conflicts, there's gray area, there's interpretation of intent and things like that that goes on. So there's a whole big process that'll continue over the coming months and years. So anything we said today, you'd want to verify and make sure that it's actually still true when you go to file your taxes at the time. And we'll, you know, as things might change or evolve, we'll try to talk about it on the show here. But this is kind of our understanding today of some of it's very straightforward and point blank and likely not to change, but there are some things that are still due for some massaging interpretation and implementation rules by the IRS that we'll probably discover as time goes by. So stay tuned for those. Paul?
And there were certainly mistakes in the, you know, when you do 870 pages, you're going to definitely have some mistakes. I know I've already found one mistake, dealing with business meal deduction. They referred to a code section number 3 and they were supposed to be code section number 4, but that was pretty minor. So, but there'll be other mistakes that people will find as they read the bill.
Right. So, have fun golfing in Scotland.
Yeah. Have a great trip, Paul.
Yeah. Can't wait to hear about how that goes.
I'm going to give it a good try.
So on a trip like that, are you hauling your own clubs over there?
Oh, yeah.
I am hauling my own clubs. I could have shipped them, but the cost was like $350. And so I decided I'll just carry them on and hopefully they'll get there. The last time I shipped my clubs, they stayed in Denver. Then I was at my location. I called them and said, well, keep it in Denver because I don't need them. And then they shipped them to the location. Then they had to ship them back to Denver. So it was a little bit of a messy situation for a few days.
But you got him back. That's the good news.
I got him back.
Nice.
Yeah, well, have a great trip and enjoy those. It stays light to like 10:30, 11 o'clock at night this time of year over there because they're so far north. So It's pretty cool.
And Scotland has such wonderful food too. So, we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, get your fill of haggis.
A lot of haggis, a lot of meat pies. Enjoy.
Yeah, enjoy. I'm sure it'll be great. So you can fill us all in when you get back.
Yeah, I can't.
So
I will.
Everybody else, thanks a lot for listening. Hopefully this was somewhat informative for you, and we'll be back with you later this week with a Q&A show. Not sure who will be attending that Q&A show, but we'll have one for you either way. Everybody stay safe and healthy, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.